Let's make today the day you get one step closer to becoming the parent you've always wanted to be and the parent your children deserve. Hi, and welcome to Powerful Parenting for Today's Kids. I am your host, Erin Taylor, and I have wanted to help parents and children literally since I was 11 years old. I created this podcast to help you make a stronger, healthier, deeper connection to your child, to understand the inevitable challenges a little better, and learn some new ways to navigate them when they occur. Thank you for spending some time with me. Now let's get this show started. Hello and welcome back to the show. Today is episode number 636, and I'm really excited to have my new friend Philip Mott here. Philip is a homeschooling father to three and a monthly contributor to First Time Parent magazine and fatheringtogether.org. He runs Kids Are People and Self-Directed Community, two online groups for parents who are practicing and supporting each other in a non-authoritarian approach to educating and raising their children. Welcome, Philip. It's so great to have you here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Erin.
I was so excited when you connected with me because I don't often hear from dad. So I really, really wanted to have this conversation with you because a lot of the work I do with parents, I work with a lot of dads, but it usually originates from the moms. So it's good to have a convo with a dad.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I do feel kind of lonely sometimes as a dad because there's just not a whole lot of dads that I meet that are kind of working in this space, but I was a former elementary school teacher. So I was kind of used to that. In my first position, I was the only male, classroom teacher in the building. So, but yes, it is kind of odd, to be the dad, like, you know, I'm the one in the family that's reading the parenting books and the parenting articles, which is not usual for most families, I don't think.
No, I do not think that is common at all. So it's pretty cool. A nice breath of fresh air.
Oh, thanks. Well, I hope so. Yeah.
So before we dive into the topic, I wanted to give my listeners a little more background on you. So you are a homeschooling dad. How did that come about?
Yeah. So, I was always interested in homeschooling. My mom had actually homeschooled a few of us, in the first few years. I never really got to homeschool very long. I started right at the end of kindergarten. I went into school. My wife was always totally against it. Like, I would never want to do that. But then we discovered, what's known as play-based learning. I learned about it in my teaching, prep, and, we were watching a few documentaries and we came across a documentary called Class Dismissed. And this introduced us to the concept of unschooling, which is, we kind of follow that framework, that way of looking at education. And, it really just changed her view. For the first time, she was really open to it and actually saw how the way that schools typically teach can be really detrimental to the learning goals that they have. And so that's really where the motivation came from, from my wife's perspective to homeschool, even though I had always been pretty interested in it.
That's really fascinating. And that concept of unschooling, I really love, but can you just give a little tiny snippet about what it is for people who may not be familiar with it?
Yeah. So unschooling, to put it really simply, is the way that we learn outside of school. it's like take what adults do outside of school. Like, anytime you want to learn something, that's the way that we do school. we really trust our kids' curiosity. And we often say that curiosity is the curriculum. Mm. So whatever they are curious about at the time, that's what we help them find resources on. So for our five-year-old right now, it's coloring and those perler beads, those things that you iron together. Well, she just turned six, actually. And she has made probably over 100 of those little patterns, where if she were to do that in school, it would be a really closely monitored activity. And she would probably only get to make one or two in art class over the period of a week or so. Mm-hmm. But in our house, we're able to, she can do 5-6 in a row and really explore the topic and her own abilities deeply. And just to illustrate that one step further, you know, think about all the fine motor skills that she has to practice by putting these tiny little beads, mm-hmm. On these little patterns, and she's following instructions sometimes, or she's coming up with her own design. And that's what so much of it is like, whether it's reading or writing, drawing. Our 8-year-old is now really interested in drawing, watching tutorials on how to draw different things on YouTube. So he spends, there was a period of a week that he spent an hour and a half a day just watching drawing tutorials. And we saw his drawing level just explode, of course, because he's practicing. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the shortest description I can come up with unschooling is, it's just the way that we learn outside of school.
And it seems like it allows kids to go deeper into the things that they're interested in.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not concerned of, we think about the breadth of topics that we're exposing them to, but we're not concerned. Like, that's not our goal, is to expose them to as many things as possible, or even a certain number of things. What we are most concerned about is continuing to nurture the curiosity, because that's what we feel like drives the motivation. That's where so much of their motivation comes from, is I want to do this. So I'm going to deal with any adversity that comes against me in the process. Where if we're trying to do math facts, which has its place, and they don't want to do it, you know, then the adversity becomes a lot more challenging.
Mm-hmm. So how do the standard typical things, the academic subjects, how do they fit in? Science, math? I mean, I know that science and math are a part of every aspect of our lives. So how does that look with an unschooling curriculum, a lack of curriculum, if you will?
Yeah. So much of it is covered in through conversations. You know, we end up talking about, of course, we read books, and so they get exposed to things like ideas like planets and rocks and the water cycle. And so we start to have some of those conversations. One thing that comes to mind when you ask that is that I think that science is taught too early in school. Because science uses language that's very abstract. Mm. And even though kids are fascinated by, I had an instructor in college that said, kids love things that are super small and super big. It's one mm-hmm. of the things, the reasons that kids love dinosaurs is because they're huge. Mm-hmm. But kids also love things like bacteria because it's small and you can't see it. Mm-hmm. But because schools have so much to cover, they sometimes don't know where to put that information. So I think they introduce it early, thinking that if the kids know about it earlier, then once they get to higher grades, they're ready for it. But I don't really follow that reasoning. I think kids need to learn things when they're ready for it, not when we think it's convenient to teach them.
Interesting. So how long do you plan to unschool your kids? How long do you think that will happen?
Well, unschooling, at least the way that I approach it, and my wife is not in complete agreement with this, so I can't totally speak for her, but my idea is that you can actually utilize a public school as part of your unschooling journey. So for me, unschooling is not anti-schooling. It's that it's whenever the tools that we have at our disposal aren't enough to meet the needs of the child from their own perspective. So for example, if, you know, my son turns 10, let's say, and he says, you know, I don't really think I'm getting enough book knowledge, and, you know, we don't have enough time to go to the library like I want to. I really think I want to be in a structured classroom. I'd say, well, school is probably the best place for that. You may not like the way you're treated, both by some of your peers and your teachers, but let's give it a try. And there's certainly families who do that, and they utilize the public school system. There's also families who don't have the circumstances to homeschool, or they don't feel that they do, and so they need to utilize the public school system or a private school. And I think that can be fine too. The unschooling, and this kind of leads into the topic I think we want to talk about today, is the unschooling is really about mutual respect, respecting the child's voice in their own education, and understanding that they want to be successful as much as you want them to be successful. It's just that their idea of success feels very different, and they don't necessarily know how to articulate it. But they want to feel successful. They want to feel like they belong in the community. And so our attitude towards them really helps kind of set that foundation.
That is a perfect segue into what we decided that we wanted to talk about today. So we decided to talk about how respect needs to be earned. I think that's a fascinating topic, because I meet so many parents who are frustrated because their kids don't respect them. And when I dig a little bit deeper, in my experience, these parents tend to fall in one of two categories. Either their kids say something rude to them and they don't correct them or call them out on it and address the behavior. And then the next time the kids say something rude, they don't do it again and again and again. And then a pattern is built where the kids are just rude and disrespectful, but it almost seems as if the parents don't feel worthy of respect. So they don't insist, you know, in a certain way upon getting respect. And then the other category I find is that parents, when they're oftentimes when they're triggered, as we all do, but some do it more than others, when they're triggered, they get frustrated and angry and they yell at their kids, or they'll say something unkind to their kids. And then when their kids are disrespectful to them, they get frustrated and angry about it. But when we look at it, they're actually modeling that kind of disrespectful behavior to their kids. So how are their kids supposed to respect them when they're not respecting their kids, or they're not earning their kids' respect by the way they're behaving? So what are your thoughts about those two categories?
It's such a challenging topic to talk about, because there's so much like history and almost evolution in that. And there's a lot of different ways to take it. I was just jotting down some notes while you were talking. So one of the things that I thought about, and I reflect on this pretty often, is when you said the kids don't respect them, you know, that's a statement that if I'm a parent and you and I are working together and I say, they just don't respect me, I'm trying to think about what am I really implying here?
How are you defining that? Right.
Yeah. Like, I'm implying, or what's inferring, a lot of meaning from my kids' actions. Mm-hmm. I'm taking it personally, and I do it too. I don't want to make it. I mean, I talk to my wife pretty often about like, I don't understand why I'm so triggered by this. Like, there's nothing about what my son or my daughter did that should be making me angry, but I feel angry and I feel disrespected. It feels rude to me. And I have experimented with trying to say things like that, but I think it's even telling a kid to be kind is kind of an abstract word. It's like, how do you explain that? How do you really explain what it means to be kind to someone, to a 5-year-old? How do you explain that to a 5-year-old? I mean, it's really challenging. And I think I'm going to get not really off topic, but it feels important to say, like, I think this idea of respect stems from a belief that we own our children.
Very good point.
Like, we, not in a sense that where we say, oh, these are my kids. Yes, they belong to us, but that doesn't necessarily mean we own them. I think we think that we own them almost like we own a pet, and that this person is here for our, I don't know what to call it, for our own, not quite ego. And none of us would admit that, but I think in our,
be aware of it.
Yeah. Like, but when we feel triggered by the way that they treat us, that is the evidence that we believe deep down that we own them, that we have a right to control the things that they do. I also think that when the way that people talk about respect when we talk about kids is different than when we talk about a mutual relationship, like a friendship, a peer, and especially a boss. When we talk about respect in terms of children, I think we think of a yes man. We want someone to just says yes, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am all the time. And that's not respect. If we had a friend, and I'm not trying to say that our kids are our friends, although I like my kids to be my friends a lot of time. If we have a friend who treats us the way we want our kids to treat us, we wouldn't enjoy them at all. They would never disagree with us. Right. They would do everything that we ask them to do.
And
there would be no like ebb and flow to the relationship. But for some reason, we don't see that as something to be desired between a parent and a child. We don't want there to be an ebb and flow. We want there to be a command reaction aspect of the relationship.
Obeying.
I don't see that as respectful. That doesn't sound like a healthy relationship to me. That sounds like an abusive relationship. If we're talking from a counseling perspective, like a marriage, and I was trying to tell the counselor that my wife doesn't respect me because she doesn't do the things I ask her to do, I think the counselor would say, "You sound pretty abusive, actually." But for some reason, that
demanding, is, tyrannical, right?
But that is what is, that's kind of the norm for parenting.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I always try to help parents to see is that our kids are really our equals. It's not a hierarchical situation, even though it looks like it on the surface, because we're older, we've been around longer, we know more. They come to us unable to sit up or feed themselves or get dressed by themselves. So they come to us very much needing everything for their survival. So that sets up this hierarchical dynamic from the day they're born, but it's not actually, I don't really feel like it's actually the way it really is. Once they're able to get dressed and feed themselves and speak and do whatever, they really are our equals. They have as much to teach us as we have to teach them. And so if we have this kind of hierarchical, you know, I give direction and you follow and you obey immediately, that is very top-down power. power difference there. But if it's more about kind of like you were saying with education, what is it that needs to be done? How can you contribute? You know, when you were talking about education, you were talking about, well, what are you interested in? And how can I support you to dive deep into that topic and learn as much as you want to learn about it before you move on to the next thing? That's a very, to me, that's a very respectful way of supporting the child to learn and use curiosity as the guidepost and the compass, which is awesome. So I think a lot of times in parenting or in the parent-child dynamic, if the house, let's say the house needs to be cleaned, well, a productive, effective way to do it is to say, okay, here are the things that need to be done. Which of us is taking which task? My kids have always been responsible from a very young age, probably age five, for cleaning the bathroom that they share. And my kids are 5 years apart. So the youngest, and then 2 years later, and then 3 years later. So total of 5 years. So of course they have all different varying levels of ability. So the youngest did the easier tasks until he was old enough. Now he's 14. He can do anything in the bathroom cleaning wise. Yeah. But when I let them know it's time to clean the bathroom, they instantly go to each other because they've been trained and taught that this is how it works. They don't even talk to me. I just say, hey guys, the bathroom needs to be cleaned today. And they instantly turn to each other and they say, I'll do the mirror and the toilet. What do you want to do? And they work it out instantly. And I think that is a respectful way to do it for siblings to figure things out and collaborate and cooperate with each other. But I think the same could be applied to the parent-child dynamic, where if the house needs to be cleaned, we say, okay, here's the things. I'll do this, this, and this. What would you like to contribute? And it has to be, of course, taking into consideration what they're developmentally able to do. Yeah. But I think that goes for anything. Learning, cooking, how we have conversations with each other, discussing a disagreement between them and their friends. It's really about, let me hear what you have to say. I want to share what I think about it. And then let's see if we can work it out and figure it out together.
Yeah, I love that. The image that was in my mind is like, you know, there's so many power struggles that happen around household chores. And I'm thinking
about
if you have someone, if you're in a it's kind of a new neighborhood and you have someone visit for lunch, you have a neighbor over for lunch and they come in. One of the ways that you can actually get to know each other is by working together on something. Mm. You say, oh, would you go ahead and get the ice out of the freezer? And like, you're just asking them to do something. They could say, I want to do this. I mean, they probably wouldn't, right. But a kid will, they'll say, no, I don't think so. But it's the same kind of thing. You're just asking them to contribute. And I think too many parents get stuck in this mindset of everything that I ask them to do, they need to do it. And we start to take that personally and we keep a log of it in our minds. And we kind of keep this logged in our minds and we keep a record of the things that they won't do. And we build up resentment in response to that.
And we create a whole story around it.
Yeah. We create meaning from that and we infer certain things. So
let's talk about having a meal. You were talking about having a meal with maybe a new neighbor, but let's talk about having a meal with our kids, just a family dinner. So let's imagine that we say to our child, can you put ice in the glasses? And our child says, I don't really want to do that. I'll put the napkins on the table. Well, we could interpret that as, wow, they're really being disrespectful. They didn't do what I asked.
Yeah.
But we could also interpret it as, oh, they just don't want to put ice in the glass, but they're happy to put napkins on the table. So we could walk away from that interaction, either feeling like, gosh, my kid disrespected me because they didn't listen when I told them what to do. Or we could walk away going, oh, look at that. I wanted them to put the ice in the cups, but they didn't want to do it. So I did it, but they did the napkins. So it worked out well anyway. And yeah, it's all the meaning we put to the situation.
They found another way to contribute. And I think kids want to contribute. And if we are only focused on what they didn't do for us, we're going to miss that.
Yes.
We're going to miss the ways that they want to contribute to the family.
And
you
I'm sorry, go ahead. I can remember mine if you want to go first.
Okay. I might lose mine. I might have already lost it. Oh, you said earlier that kids have just as much to teach us. Mm-hmm. And my caveat to that is if we're open to it.
If we allow it.
If we are, we have so much to learn from them. If we can slow down long enough to see how they live their life and we respect their curiosity and their own autonomy, we'll learn a lot from watching them. I want to be more like my kids in different ways. Mm-hmm. The same way that when you have a mutual respectful relationship with your spouse, you want to be like your spouse, or you want to be like some of your loved ones. Maybe you don't want all of their traits, but you see how their personality differences are beneficial to them and to you. And I sometimes wish I was more like my son and my daughter. You know, my daughter is a prolific creator. She just makes stuff all the time. Whatever she's in this, if she's coloring, she does 15 pages. If she's making the perler beads, she does 10 different projects. Where my oldest, he does one project, but he does it really well. He does it fully. And it's just so different. I wish I had more of that, more of both of those things in me.
Mm, I totally understand that. And I agree fully. So what I was thinking about in that interaction with, we imagine the dinner, the family dinner, mm-hmm. and you were saying how we keep a log in our head of all the times they didn't do what we asked them to do, or they talked back, or they resisted, or they dug their heels in, you know, there's a million different things. But as much as we're keeping a record of the pattern and the tick marks of all the things they didn't do, they're also aware of the pattern, mm-hmm. not only of the words that are said, but the energy. And if it's a pattern of, you know, we're going into, I mean, I see this a lot with bedtime with parents, but let's use the mealtime as an example. If we ask our kids to put the ice in the cups and they resist, then we're already going to be a little bit triggered and annoyed, possibly, because we asked them to do something and they did not obey. So if we're staying in that energy, when they say, well, I don't really want to put the ice in, but I'll put the napkins on, then we're not going to see that as a cooperative thing or a collaborative compromise. We're going to see that as they didn't do what we said. They didn't want to do what they said, what we said, they're resisting. If we don't see it that way, then we can see the cooperation and the collaboration and everybody's working together and it's fine. But if that pattern happens a couple of times in a row where we ask them to do something, they don't want to do the exact thing we asked, but they may or may not be willing to do something else. The next time dinner comes, we're going to have it. They're going to hear it in our voice, in our tone of voice. They're going to see it. They're going to feel it in our body. Our energy is going to be, can you put the ice in the glasses, please? And they're going to feel that we're already going to be tense and we're going to be prepped for battle. And so we're already going into that interaction kind of like in our battle stance. So our kids are going to go right into their battle stance. And then we're going to be battling over who's putting ice in the glasses. Oh my gosh. So the dynamic can so easily be set up where we're both ready for battle before anyone's even said a word to anyone, because we're in that unconscious dance that we've created and we're just doing our part. We're just playing the role. And so somehow, and those patterns happen with mealtimes, and they happen at bedtime, and they happen at homework time, and they happen at chore time, and they happen at let's get our shoes on and go, get out the door time, all kinds of times. And
yeah,
someone has to break that cycle in order for anything to be done differently. And it's probably going to fall to us to have the awareness and the understanding to break that cycle. So maybe if the pattern is every time I ask them to put ice in the glass, they say no. Now I'm annoyed. Now next dinner, I'm already annoyed when I ask for the thing I know they're going to say no to. Maybe we change a whole thing up and say, how about I put ice in the cups today and you do the napkins? Or, you know, what would you like to do to help dinner get on the table? And
that's
just
true. We often
totally change it.
We often give kids the most boring tasks, don't we? Like, we give them the things that we think they can do, but a lot of times they want to try the hard stuff.
Like pouring the glass, pouring the water or something.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you came across it was fairly viral. I'll send you a link to it so you can share it with your audience. But there was a toddler trying to pour grape juice into a glass, and a disaster. I mean, it must have been maybe even a 2 liter, but like a 1 liter bottle.
Heavy.
It was still one third of the way full, and hardly any of it ended up in the cup. I mean, but and the comments are so funny. You have people that are like, this is why I don't want to have kids. They're so messy. Some people are like, she's adorable. She's given it her best. And even some are critics of like, why did the parent let her waste so much juice? And, you know, people on comments, but it's such a brilliant illustration of kind of what we're talking about, of like giving kids the space to mess up. And it's hard to mess up putting out the napkins on the table. And that's why it's not interesting to kids. Kids right. like trying.
They like stuff. Challenge.
Yeah. So something I was thinking about when you were talking about like someone's got to break the cycle, I thought of the term like flip the switch, like the things that make parenting hard, like bedtime, like mealtime, like homework time. I think those are the opportunities that we're missing. If we can flip the switch on those and kind of flip our mindset and start to think of, instead of these being the obligatory activities of parenting that get in the way of spending our quality time with them, what if these actually become our opportunities for quality time? And I learned this from Janet Lansbury when we had our firstborn. Her area of content is focused mostly on infant to pre-K. And she really wrote about respect a lot, and it impacted me a great deal and probably made unschooling very realistic to me. But the fact that diapering, for example, an infant wasn't a distraction from the fun parts of being a parent. It was actually the most important part. It was my chance to be one-on-one with my infant or toddler and start to talk in a way that was respectful and warm to them and actually invite their participation into the diaper change instead of fighting them, which sets a precedent, not only in my mind, but partially in their mind too. You know, I would give them little warnings like, this wipe is going to be cold, or like, I need you to lift up your bottom. And they would be like, you know, they're kind of like contorting. And I was communicating with a 7 or 7 month old or a 15 month old in ways that I never thought I could. And that flipped the switch for me. I started to see, it changed the way that I taught, And it changed the way that I worked with other young people, where I started to see the things that we all fear as opportunities to actually get close to the people that we care about the most. So I think that's one of the ways, and it's so tough for me. I was going to say that's one of the ways that we really flip that framework. But it's very, like, I do not like mealtimes. I have an 8, a 6, and a, what, how old is she? 3-year-old. And so mealtimes are kind of just like silly. It's like, it's not very fun for me. And the 3-year-old takes forever. She takes so long to eat. And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, I can't wait to do the next thing. But it's such a good thing to reflect on and think about. This is my opportunity to get uninterrupted one-on-one time with my kids. And so I try to come up with different things that we can talk about. And we tell knock-knock jokes and make fart noises at the table and stuff. Many people may think that's inappropriate, but you know, we just try to find ways to laugh. And I think those are the opportunities that we're so often missing. And I think it actually slows the clock down. I think that it makes the time go slower. And isn't that what most parents actually complain about the most, is how fast the time goes by? And when we find ways to try to cherish, which is what the older generation always tells us to, like, cherish these moments. Like, well, how do I do that? I think it's when we slow down and say the things that I dread the most are actually my biggest opportunities for connection.
That is so beautiful. And the thing that I think is most powerful that you're saying, and the thing I think is so inspiring, is that you used mealtime as an example, and you admitted that mealtime is not your favorite time.
No,
but, not even close. But yet you have made a decision and set an intention to find ways to make it enjoyable for all of you. And I think that's so powerful, because it's so easy to make something fun that you already enjoy, right?
Yeah.
If you love cooking and your kids are adventurous eaters and they're willing to eat anything you put in front of them, of course it's easy to make mealtime fun, because everybody likes it. The challenge is to make something fun and pleasant and enjoyable and successful when it's not your favorite thing. So I love that example that you gave.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's always encouraging to hear people respond in a way that's like, that's inspiring. Like, oh man, that's awesome. And I'll add even more to it that I think one of the things that is the most challenging is that I see it as my responsibility to make it enjoyable for me. So I think a lot of parents actually, they actually know that mealtime is a great time for quality time. I'm not telling them anything new. They're like, well, yeah, of course, mealtime is important. It's a great time to connect. But the difference, I think, is that we're conditioned to think that it's our child's responsibility, that they are the one lacking when we don't enjoy mealtime, that they are the one that needs to change. And the real switch is that I put the responsibility on myself. When I'm not enjoying my kids, that's not their fault. That's my responsibility, because my happiness actually, like, it's not possible for another person to make me unhappy.
Ding, 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 ding.
My happiness comes from within. So there's some sort of meaning that I'm, you know, sort of putting on top of whatever is happening. And so I take the responsibility when I'm not enjoying mealtime. On my best days, I'm the one that's saying, this is what I want to do differently. On my worst days, I'm pointing the finger at my kids and saying, you need to change this about what you're doing. You need to treat me differently. And that's not to say that we talked about boundaries a little bit earlier. That's not to say that I never tell my kids that I want them to treat me differently. But that's not the first, I try to make sure that that's not the first place I go. I try to always take responsibility for what I'm doing first. And then if there's something I need to communicate of, like, I'm trying to explain to the kids that my feelings are hurt when I put together a meal and they ask me why I didn't make something different. Mm. And that is a really hard thing to communicate to a child. Like, how do you explain that it hurts my feelings? It feels mean. I mean, it feels like they're yelling at me when all they're just curious. Like, why didn't you make macaroni and cheese today? Like, I just want to know. And I'm like, but what I feel like has happened is they've taken a baseball bat and hit me in the chest with it.
Right.
And some might say, well, you're being too sensitive. It's like, I'm just being me. Like, that's just how I feel, you know, and I don't want to feel that way. And I don't think it's their fault, but I still think it's my responsibility to communicate to them honestly that when they do complain about what I make, that it does hurt my feelings. I'm always willing to change what I make, but I'd like to learn about that before I make it instead of, you know, once it's already delivered. It's like getting a letter from someone and they're like, I don't like this. Like, you would never say that to another adult, but kids do because they don't, you know, they're new. They don't know how we operate yet.
Right. They don't have that. They don't have as much of a filter as we learn as we grow up.
Yeah.
They're just saying what's coming to their mind. Or, you know, many kids, mine included, would be happy if I made macaroni and cheese every single night for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
But that's just not reasonable. So it is very predictably expected that would be a question that would come up in my house. Why are we having mac and cheese tonight? Because we can't have it 7 nights a week. But they might think it every day.
Yeah, and I might say, like, you know, what I want to eat, I think, is important too. And mm-hmm. I don't want mac and cheese again. Like, I don't mind making it for you, but I'd like to try something else. And maybe you'll like it too. Those are tough conversations because I can hear the authoritarian view of, you know, I can hear the voice of my parents and then their parents saying, when I was your age, like, I was lucky to get anything on my plate.
Or if you didn't eat, you didn't get any food until breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah. There were things like that were really shame inducing, you know. Cleaning off your plate was a big thing. And our generation, I think, is really trying to get rid of some of that stuff, but that doesn't mean that we don't sometimes go back to it in our minds and think, well, my parents treated me this way. Maybe I should just keep passing it along and saying, like, look, you should be thankful I gave you anything for the way you treated me today. You know, like, mm-hmm. We're tempted to say that sometimes because kids can be really rude. They can hurt our feelings a lot. And it's hard to communicate about it. It takes time.
And sometimes they don't even realize when they say something that feels rude to us, like you were saying, why didn't you make mac and cheese? They might not have any rude intention behind that. They're just asking a question, but we feel like we've been assaulted because we're standing there and we're busy and we're making this dinner and then we give it to them and they seem like they don't want it. And so we feel offended and hurt and angry and resentful and all the things. And there might not even be a story attached to it. It just may be a question.
Yeah. Yeah. And we would hopefully never say that to our spouse. Like, why didn't you make this? You know, that would be so, so rude. But our kids do that like 20 times a day. Like, they ask these questions and it's very challenging to kind of flip the switch on that stuff.
And just try not to take it personally.
Yeah. I don't want to paint the picture for anyone listening that this should be an easy switch. It's not. That's one of the hardest things I think I've ever done is to try to remove the way that I was treated as a child from my own habits.
It's one of the hardest things that I think most parents have to figure out, because we just automatically slip into the way we were, it was modeled for us. And if we wanted to be, whether that was positive or negative, good or bad, whatever, we just easily slip into that. And it takes real conscious awareness and intention to change that pattern, because that's what we know. If we want to change the pattern, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to think, about like how many adults did I experience that I felt like actually trusted and respected me as a person. And I just like two adults out of the 150 adults that I probably interacted with truly trusted my decisions and respected like where I was coming from. And that's I just don't have very many to like go back to and sort of rewind the tape and think, oh, that's, I can do this. If you're a person that you can look back and you have five or six adults in your life that you felt like you felt truly respected by and that they trusted you, you're probably a different person. You probably experience life very differently than I do. Someone like me does. You probably don't have some of these problems, because I think it makes that big of a difference when you're trusted by the people who care for you.
I think it's very true. And when you talked about that, I immediately thought of my dad. When I was growing up, my parents were terrific, and I was very fortunate to have a great relationship with both of them. And when I think about my dad deeply respected me, and he honored me, and he loved me, and he supported me, and he would flip over backwards to try and help me with whatever it was. And so that's one of the many good things that he modeled for me and passed down to me. One of the very few not so good things is he was very, very anal about crumbs and stickiness and messes, like food stuff. And he grew up in the Depression. And so it informed very much some of the ways that he was about home. I'm sure they had bugs in their house. They lived in a row house in the city. He was very, very against drawing bugs, attracting bugs. No bugs, no crumbs, no food, no nothing. You know, everything had to be cleaned up just so. So I understand where that came from, but he passed that down to me too, so that when my son was born, like the toddler pouring the grape juice, I can't wait to see that video, because I wish I would have had the ability to allow him to pour grape juice everywhere or grapefruit juice everywhere. I got the same thing. I don't want a sticky spill. I don't want crumbs everywhere. You know, it took me a while to allow him to make his own peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, because I didn't want the jelly to squirt onto the counter, because then I'd have a mess. And this sounds so ridiculous now that I'm older and my son is 19 and I'm thinking about it, ridiculous. But it's a great example of how we just so easily slip into the pattern of what we were taught. I slipped into so many of the good patterns that my dad taught me, he modeled for me, and my kids are the lucky beneficiaries of all that good stuff. But at least my older son had to put up with me not letting him make his own peanut butter and jelly sandwiches when he was motivated and ready to try it, because I didn't want him making a mess. And if I could do, you know, if I had this awareness when he was born, which we never have this when they're first born, but if I had had that awareness, I could have said, okay, I can feel myself being triggered that he could make a mess right now, but he wants to try it and I shouldn't hamper him. I should allow that. So I have to control my own trigger about the mess and the crumbs and the stickiness so that I can let him try, because he wants to try. I shouldn't stop that or discourage it. Like you're saying about unschooling, encourage their curiosity.
Yeah, the phrase that's coming to mind right now is there's learning in the mess.
Absolutely.
We talked about that video, and I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed, like, look, it's like, where was that? Because I want you to be able to put it in the show notes, because it's just hysterical. But there is so much learning in the mess.
Yes.
And if we want kids to, I'll say it the way Alfie Cohn says it, if we want kids to make decisions, we have to give them practice making decisions.
Oh, beautiful.
We can't take that process from them. It's messy. My kids, when we do a big breakfast, which we do every Sunday, they want to break the eggs.
Yes.
But almost, you know, for the first 3 weeks, 4 weeks, there's egg on the floor every time.
Yes.
And it's messy. And yeah, I could just have them say, well, why don't you put the napkins on? Or, and it's like, no, I want to do the big things. I want to do the things that look hard because they're interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. The first time I saw my son break an egg, it was just like, he's tapping it. I'm like, just tapping it. I'm like, no, you're never going to crack it. And then bam. And then it just explodes. And it's so messy.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's one of the best things that my parents did, is there were five of us, so they couldn't afford to watch for the messes. So we actually ended up learning a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
But then sometimes respect was a big thing for my mom and my dad. And it's like, if we would kind of cross them, they would just become so irate. And my mom especially just had a real big temper, and she would say that now. I mean, I'm not saying anything that she's not aware of and that she's actively working on. She's, you know, she still kind of gets an attitude because she feels like the grandkids should treat her in a certain way. And she loves what we're doing, but she's skeptical of it sometimes. It's like, well, what if they don't want to do the things that they need to do? And my, you know, somewhat cavalier response is they probably weren't going to do it anyway. Mm. You know, we didn't, there were things that you were trying to get us to do that we didn't do, mom, like, mm-hmm. and you spanked us and it didn't work. So why would I do that more? Right. I'm looking for a new, like a better way to do things, because I didn't like getting spanked, both the physical and the emotional part of it. I didn't like feeling like my parents were mad at me for something I did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are so many things to work on in parenting, so many different aspects, so many different layers, so many different categories. And I think, you know, when I think back to things I did or didn't do, or how I did things as my kids have been growing up, there are some things I'm really happy that I did them the way I did them. And there are other things, like the crumbs on mm-hmm. the counter, that I wish I could have changed that. So I think we're always going to find things that when we look back, we're going to go, oh,
yeah,
gosh, I wish I could have changed that. And hopefully we can identify those things and figure out better ways to do those things and cheer ourselves on when we recognize that we did something, we did a really good job of handling a situation, because parenting is hard and it's very complicated and there are many layers and we can screw up many, many things, but we can also triumph in many, many things. So I think it's just important to pat ourselves on the back when we do a good job and learn a better way when we notice that we didn't do it so well that time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's well said. I think what I would say about it is that it just, like, you can't, there's no such thing as a perfect parent, because mm-mm. just like there's no such thing as a perfect marriage. You can have a really great marriage, but you still have the two people that are involved.
Yes.
There was a pastor that kind of joked about it one time, and it's always stuck with me. He said when he did weddings, he often would say, I don't know if this was real, that he would actually say it, but it's a funny thing. It's like, this is a perfect marriage. The only problem is the husband and the wife.
That's really good.
That's the only thing that makes it imperfect.
Only problem.
That's the thing is like, the only problem with your relationship with your son is you and your son, because you're two people that are trying to learn how to live together. And, and it's not parenting, it's relating.
Right.
It's people. And, people are difficult. So yeah, that's kind of how I would wrap up my perspective on it.
So respect cannot be insisted upon or demanded. I think we agree that respect has to be earned. It has to be mutual. We should respect our kids, and hopefully they respect us because they feel the mutual and the environment of mutual respect. And then they will have no other desire other than to be respectful, because that's all they know. That's all they're experiencing. Well, in the ideal sense, occasionally we're going to have a temper tantrum, but so are they.
Yeah.
But if we can just get right back on track and get back to relating in a better way, that's good for them. And it's good for us too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this has been so much fun, Philip. I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. This is just awesome. Well, yeah. But I'm sure your kids want to go make some crafts or do something interesting.
That's right.
So
yeah, the 8-year-old has passed my office a few times, like, "Hey, what's Dad doing?"
I love it. So where can people find more about you and your work and the organizations you're a part of and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So the easiest place to connect with me is actually on Twitter. That's where I'm most active. So at Philip Mott one, with one L in Philip. And, but then you can also find the parent groups on, through my website, philipmott.com. I think the only one that's actually linked on there is the self-directed community. And so this is a community of parents who are dedicated to exploring what we call self-directed education, not necessarily unschooling, but often unschooling, with their kids. And so it's just kind of a support group where people can chat with each other. And we host a monthly meetup, where we get on a Zoom call together and just chat to catch up and, talk about the things that we love talking about, which is how we love relating to our kids and how we feel like we don't fit in most, parent circles because we relate in a weird way. You know, we do talk a lot about respect. And, so those are probably the two places to connect with me.
Super. Well, I will make sure I post all of that in the show notes. And awesome. I want to thank you for spending this time with me today, because I really loved our chat. And I think we touched on some really thought-provoking things for parents to listen to.
Anytime you want to chat. Thank you so much for having me. And, I hope your audience really enjoys it, and I hope it helps you work with the parents that you're working with. Thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you. All right. So that wraps up today's episode. Wherever you are in this world, I hope that you make it a very connected and respectful day for yourself. That wraps up this episode of Powerful Parenting for Today's Kids. If you know anyone who could benefit from this episode or this podcast in general, please share it with them. Also, I always love hearing feedback from my listeners. I welcome you to send me an email to erin@erin-taylor.com if you have any comments or questions that come up for you in an episode. Our children are our future. Parenting them is the most sacred task we will ever be asked to do. It truly does take a village to raise a child. Let's help each other to raise our children to be who it is they are meant to be. If at any point you feel like you need a little extra help and support, reach out to me. I am here to help you.